Welcome to MetaStrategy's Forum on World-Class IT, a weekly conversation with people who are shaping the technology landscape. I'm Peter High, and I'm pleased to welcome Bill Ritter to the broadcast. Bill was the 41st governor of Colorado, serving in that capacity from 2007 through 2011. Currently, Bill is the energy strategy partner at Blackhorn Ventures, where he focuses on the build economy, the energy sector, and the transportation sector. Bill is also the founder of the Center for the New Energy Economy at Colorado State University. In that role, Bill drives the organization's mission to work with state governments and the private sector to transform energy production across the country. As governor, Bill oversaw Colorado's renewable energy-focused transition to create an environmentally friendly energy economy. Bill received his bachelor's degree in political science from Colorado State University and a JD from the University of Colorado School of Law. I recently caught up with Bill by phone from his office in Denver, Colorado, and our conversation covered World-Class IT Principle 3, Project and Portfolio Management, as Bill discussed the new technologies that will assist in managing energy portfolios, and Principle 5, External Partnerships, as he discussed why it's more effective to work with the states and the private sector to achieve this energy transformation than it is to partner with the federal government. We also discussed Bill's success in transforming Colorado's energy economy, the budding entrepreneurial spirit in Colorado, Bill's work as strategy partner at Blackhorn Ventures, and a variety of other topics. If you like what you hear, we'd be grateful if you give us a rating on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. Thank you. The Forum on World-Class IT is brought to you by Transmit Security. Transmit Security designs and develops platforms that address problems in security and usability by making it easy for developers to implement advanced authentication techniques ranging from biometrics to behavioral profiling. As the risk of cyber attacks and hacks increase, companies need a more effective way of preventing unauthorized access. I recently caught up with the Transmit Security CEO, Mickey Budai. This week, Mickey provides his top tips for legacy companies struggling with the management of in-house legacy systems.
The first one I call legacy. I'm seeing quite a few large enterprises struggling today with legacy in-house developed systems. These are systems that were developed 10 years ago, sometimes 20 years ago. They're extremely hard to maintain. They were developed using technologies that are no longer supported and require skills that are relatively hard to get today. Many of these legacy systems are core strategic systems and as such are connected to many other systems and processes in the organization. And replacing them is almost impossible. Data migration is a nightmare. Redoing all the interfaces is a nightmare. Even identifying the interfaces is very complex. On the other end, I'm seeing large enterprises today rushing into what I call do-it-yourself large-scale development projects of very similar systems. These projects are basically the legacy systems of the future. In terms of 10 years from now, CIOs are going to face the very same problem they are facing today with their legacy in-house developed systems. I think that as an enterprise, you need an extremely good reason to adopt a do-it-yourself over a buy decision. Your architects may tell you that they can build it, but no matter how much you try, you won't be able to estimate the total cost of the project over the next 10 years, nor the time it's going to take you to complete the task. My suggestion is to focus your development efforts on building interfaces to all your existing systems so you can more easily plug in new services. Don't focus your efforts on building the legacy of the future.
Tune in next week when Mickey discusses the value of abstraction layers. Bill Ritter, welcome to the Forum on World-Class IT.
Thanks, Peter. I'm glad to be with you.
It's a pleasure to speak with you. Governor Ritter, you were the 41st governor of Colorado. You served a term from 2007 to 2011. And I know that one of your areas of passion prior to within your time as governor and certainly after the governorship is the whole topic of the new energy economy. This is something that really
was one of the big initiatives during your time as governor of Colorado. And I wonder if you can just, as a definition of terms, talk a bit about how you see the new energy economy defined as well as how you see it developing.
Yeah, so we had a whole way of thinking about it, my team and I. It was about being able to utilize Colorado's energy resources, but to do so in an environmentally favorable way, a friendlier way than we had in the past, to do so in a way that developed Colorado's economy, and also to do so in a way that was equitable. And you'll notice there's a mnemonic device in there because it's all four E's: energy, environment, the economy, and equity for customers, utility customers. And so I signed 57 different laws I signed 57 different bills into the law. And it was really about taking what had been a traditional fossil fuel economy and transitioning it over time into an economy that really focused on growing renewables, on utilizing natural gas as a part of a coal to gas transition, and on energy efficiency, saving energy, energy conservation, and trying to do so in a way where we protected the utility customers, where we protected the customers of municipal utilities or rural co-ops. We have a real mix in Colorado. And, this is a perspective now. I took office in January of 2007. So it's 11 and a half years ago when I look back, and it's kind of an interesting thing. It worked. Our major utility has now filed a plan. I signed a bill to say we should go to 30% renewable portfolio, renewable energy for the investor-owned utility, the biggest utility in the state, Xcel Energy. They are going to meet that 30. They're going to meet it early. They're going to meet it with reducing customers' bills over time. And they have decided now to go to 55% by 2025 if the Public Utility Commission lets them. And that's the market. What we did was help create a market for renewable resources, a market for energy efficiency, a market for natural gas as well. And over time, we will also see a real serious decline in emissions from our energy portfolio. That was the new energy economy.
That's excellent. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about your vision then and how that's evolved since in the role of the government versus the private sector, public and private sector symbiosis, collaboration, how those work together in order to develop this in a more full blossom way that you're describing.
Yeah, as governor, I think you do focus a lot on the kinds of actions that government can take to, you know, spur activity, to spur economic activity, particularly. We did this during the Great Recession, which was even a lot more difficult. Since then, I left office and went to Colorado State University and started a center called the Center for New Energy Economy. And I've really refined my sense about the importance of the mix between government action and the creation and the expansion of markets and how those two things can kind of work together. I know we're going to talk later in this show about the fact that technology and finance have to be a part of that mix as well. But, you know, when you're, like I said, when you're a governor, you're really focused on the policy aspects of it, hoping that over time the economy, the economic activity will take off. And now I come to appreciate how important those two levers are in working together.
Mm. And as you mentioned, you are were the founder in 2011, shortly after the conclusion of your governorship, founder and director now of the Center for the New Energy Economy at Colorado State University, your alma mater, where you did your undergraduate work. And I wonder if you could talk a bit about its makeup, the center's makeup, that is, how you've stacked the mission of it and so forth.
The mission, and I guess really the thesis when I began, was that it was important that we work at the state level on what I foresaw as the energy transition, this transition, particularly out of coal-fired generation, in part because of the environment, but also in part because of markets and just the cheap, long supply of natural gas, the downward price decline in renewables, the very cheap energy efficiency retrofits that you can get, all of which over time we're going to, I think, cause trouble for those who were relying upon coal-fired generation. And I thought the states were an important place to conduct that activity, to convince governors and legislators, utility regulators, that states had a real role to play. And again, you know, I mean, we're not flattering ourselves. We were right about that. And in part, looking at the Trump administration, we were really right about that. There's so much where there's a clawing back of different kinds of regulations that really were supportive of the energy transition, that states are the only place, states and local governments and the private sector, but certainly not the federal government. Relying upon Congress to pass comprehensive energy legislation is a long, long bet. And if you look in the states, we monitor every piece of energy legislation introduced in a state legislature all the way to where it either dies or becomes law. There's been years where there were 4,500 separate bills introduced in state legislatures. And that's only the legislative part of it. By the way, only 600 of those became law. That's the legislative part of it. But there's so much else on the regulatory side, either through the utility commissions or air quality commissions or a variety of other kinds of regulatory commissions in the 50 states, that really can impact this energy transition so much more than what we're going to see at the federal level for a long time.
That's very interesting. And I know on the heels of that description, you do actually spend a lot of time with utility chief executive officers, with governors of states, about what you have referred to as energy transition. And I wonder if you could speak a little bit about that work and maybe give us a little bit of, in addition to Colorado, other states that you feel are making this transition effectively and maybe some of the methods they've used in so doing.
Well, I think the transition is really something that is happening around the country. And, you know, it's pretty remarkable if you look at the major utilities that now have set lower or zero emission targets. And they're about 2040 or 2050. Some have targets even inside of that. But this was not commonplace. In fact, it would have been almost unique for a utility 10 years ago to stand up and say, we want to hit these emissions targets. We want to do it with this combination of fuels. But now some of the biggest utilities in the world are committing to cleaner energy in 2030, committing to very low emissions in 2040, zero emissions in 2050. And so that's part of the transition. Second part of it is states are realizing this. And interestingly, while there's this really serious partisan divide around the issues of energy and environment in the United States Congress, in the House, and the Senate, that exists. It's not that it's non-existent at the state level, but it's very different than it is at the federal level. Some of the biggest movers on energy policy at the state level have been Republican governors. Mm-hmm. Governor Sandoval in Nevada has been really a significant force for clean energy in Nevada. Governor Snyder in Michigan. Governor Hogan in Maryland, Governor Baker in Massachusetts. These are all examples of places where Republican governors have done a fair amount of work on this topic of trying to be part of an energy transition. So I have an analyst that works for me. He's one of the best air experts in the West. His name's Patrick Cummins, and he's worked for the Western governors, and he's worked for Western Climate Initiative, and he's worked for the EPA. And so he did an analysis of the planned coal retirements. 45% of all the coal that existed in 2017 in the Western grid, 11 states, is going to be retired in 10 years, 45%. And then we looked at the age of the plants and the age of the scrubbers, and we really think another 45% of what exists in 2017 will be retired in the next decade. So over a 20-year period, we'll see 90% of the coal that's domestically generating energy, that's going to go away. And we've presented this to major utilities in the West. They don't disagree with us. So that's the energy transition. That's the Western example, but it's happening in the Midwest. It's happening in the Northeast. It's happening in the Southeast. And some of it's around emissions, but a lot of it's just the market forces that happen when you have this really steep decline in renewable prices, the onset of storage, the steep decline in the pricing of storage. And then you add to that, you know, natural gas and the long supply chain for the cheap production of natural gas.
Very interesting. Additionally, Governor Ritter, you were recently named a strategy partner at Blackhorn Ventures, which is a collective of experts dedicated to supporting the entrepreneurs that are changing the world, as I'm quoting from the site of the of Blackhorn Ventures. I wonder if you could talk a bit about your role there.
You know, there have been venture capitalists come and go that focus on impact, certainly, you know, on the clean tech side. We've seen, you know, some startups that have made it and made it in a pretty big way. This is a serious group of people who approached me about joining them because they wanted to focus their efforts on three sectors, on the built environment, on the energy sector, and on the transportation sector. And like I said earlier in this podcast, I said that I had this real appreciation for the power of government and policy making to really influence how a transition could occur. Over time, I've gained an even better appreciation for the importance of markets, but then also a real appreciation for the need for new technologies to solve some of the problems that happen when this transition has taken place. What's fascinating about these three sectors that Blackhorn Venture is focusing on is that the three sectors are not stovepipes, that we're going to see emerging of things having to do with these sectors in the built environment, in transportation, and in energy. There's going to be a lot of overlap among those three. There's going to be a lot of nexus among those three. So if you're thinking about the built environment, and you're thinking about energy conservation, thinking about how to manage an energy portfolio of a building really well, there's going to be new technologies that come and allow us to do that. They allow us even better than we can now to manage our energy systems remotely. And that's going to be, you know, a technology that we may not have thought of now, but Blackhorn's on the lookout for that. As well in the energy sector, I think there's going to be so much that happens that interrelates with transportation. The market forces behind the electric vehicle, some of those were policy things. The Trump administration has cut back on that in the last week, or at least they proposed a rule to cut back on that. But electric vehicles, I really think they're going to be a significant part of our future, and utilities are going to have to figure out how to manage national loads, not just manage state by state or utility by utility. But if you have 18-wheelers in this country powered by 1-megawatt batteries that are traveling throughout the country, then there's going to be a real need for a data analysis that looks at that and a technology or a platform that allows utilities throughout the country to manage that kind of mobility. There's still going to be the electric vehicle in the home that's going to be taking off the grid and putting back onto the grid, but there's also going to be a variety of other kinds of storage technologies, and again, things that we haven't imagined yet. What I like about Blackhorn Ventures is you've got a group of very imaginative people that, in my view, can see around corners. They can tell what's going to happen in the built environment in 5 to 10 to 15 years and what's going to happen in the energy sector and those kinds of things that I said, you know, are connected or overlapping. And the same thing with the built environment. So energy, built environment, transportation, those three things overlapping. And you've got a group of people who seem to be very imaginative themselves about the kinds of things they need to invest in. I don't think technology solves every problem we have as society and solves every problem we have with respect to climate change or environmental issues. But I think technology and the financing of technology is absolutely crucial to us finding the right kinds of solutions.
And obviously but Blackhorn Ventures is based in Colorado and presumably at least some of the investments are likely to be made in your home state. And I wonder actually if you could take a moment to talk about Colorado, generally speaking, some of the different cities across the state as technology hubs of sorts. I know from past conversations I've had with a number of entrepreneurs, they've talked about the rise of places like Denver and Boulder as places that are becoming more attractive to start businesses, especially relative to some of the more mature venture areas that are becoming very, very expensive and very crowded. And maybe you could take a moment to talk a bit about your perspective there.
Well, I think it's fair to say that Colorado has a great history for kind of an entrepreneurial spirit. So that sort of startup mentality already, I think, exists among Coloradans and in the culture in Colorado. We also have, I think, a real good history where high tech is concerned. If you think about just software engineers, Fort Collins, Boulder, and Denver are three of the top 10 cities in the country for the number of software engineers. And so there's a lot of things manufactured here that are part of a technology sort of revolution that started in the, I'd say, late 70s, the early 80s. We have a significant aerospace industry and certainly in terms of technology, a high-tech aerospace industry that exists here. And then we have, you know, a group of people that I think over time have decided this is a great place to bring financial companies, whether it's private equity or venture capital. There's been some ups and downs, as I've described before, and certainly going through the Great Recession, there were some difficult times for both private equity and venture capital. But I think we've been on an upward tick. We have historic low unemployment rates. We have a lot of in-migration, and that in-migration has to do with a lot of young people and millennials. And there's great brain power in this state and brain power moving into the state. And then, you know, we have these universities. We have great research universities. I developed a collaboratory. Actually, I funded a collaboratory. My predecessor started it among the National Renewable Energy Laboratory, the University of Colorado, Colorado School of Mines, and the university I'm at, Colorado State University. And that collaboratory still exists to try and help technology, to try and help the research universities get through that valley of death where technology is concerned. And those kinds of institutions that are helping think about that, they attract the kind of capital necessary to really help startups go from stem to stern.
Well, Governor Bill Ritter, thank you so much for joining us on the Forum on World Class IT, sharing some of your perspectives from your time in office, from your time since leaving office, the various ventures you're now a part of. It's been a great conversation.
Thank you. I really appreciate it, Peter. Take
Excellent.
Care.
Wonderful. Thank you again.
Thanks for listening to the Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please rate us on iTunes or through whatever other source you use for podcasts. And please join me next week when my guest will be John Chambers, the former Chief Executive Officer of Cisco. You've just listened to a podcast in a series we call MetaStrategy's Forum on World Class IT. If you like what you've heard, please consider reading my book, World Class IT, Why Businesses Succeed When IT Triumphs, published by Josie Bass, a division of Wiley Press, in December of 2009. Both the book and the Forum on World Class IT offer stories from a wide range of top IT leaders relating to MetaStrategy's five principles of world class IT. The five principles are as follows. Principle one is people, and it's really the foundational principle. Without the right people doing the right jobs at the right time, it'll be nearly impossible to achieve excellent performance. The second principle is infrastructure. We like to say that this is the principle that separates proactive organizations from reactive ones. If infrastructure is not reliably performing its tasks, the IT organization will become stuck in reactive mode, consistently fighting fires. If systems and hardware and networks and so on work reliably, then a larger portion of the organization can think about the future. The third principle is project and portfolio management. This is the engine through which new capabilities can be brought to bear on behalf of the company. It is important to ensure that projects are delivered on time, on budget, and on target, and that the portfolio collectively supports the objectives of the business. The fourth principle is IT and business partnerships. It's important that, first and foremost, the different parts of IT, from business analysis to development and QA, through to support and all other aspects of IT, communicate effectively and efficiently. It's equally important, then, that IT develop a partnering relationship with the business that it is a part of. If the three prior principles are done well, then IT should earn a place at the strategy setting table, driving different parts of the business strategy. The fifth and last principle is external partnerships. Outsourcing is becoming a crucial weapon that organizations are employing, and managing these relationships to ensure that value is achieved is critical. In the fourth principle, the organization has learned and contributed to the discussion about what is strategic and what is not. Once that's clear, then it will be easier to determine which aspects of IT might be better managed by external partners or vendors. For more information on these five principles and the sub-principles that are associated with each, please visit our website at www.metastrategy.com, and please share your thoughts and comments by contacting us at feedback@metastrategy.com. And our theme music was written by David Arman. I'm Peter High. Thanks for listening.